Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of One Perfect Game, the show about video games and the people who play them. My name is Matt Tilby. I am your host for this wonderful adventure. And my guest for today's episode is a presenter on PlayStation Access, bringing some awesome PS content out of the UK, and also a contributor to the No Sleep podcast, an anthology of short original horror stories. It should be no surprise what one of my guests' big interests is in that case. I am, of course, delighted to welcome the wonderful Ash Millman to the show. Ash, welcome on in. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing really good, thank you. How are you?
I'm struggling to get through this intro for some reason, but yes, I'm doing very well on this this wonderful Saturday night. But another interesting sort of podcast guest with some interesting tastes in all things media. But I guess it's been a busy time for you. You've got back recently from LA, where you played Star Wars Jedi Survivor a little bit early. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so at Access, we get to go on a few things like that, which are incredible. I'm very, very grateful for. But going to LA for the first time was crazy. Like, we went to Disneyland whilst we were out there, obviously was amazing. Did all the Jedi experiences, built a lightsaber, walked around, said hello to the Mandalorian. It was very exciting. But yeah, it's incredible. It's just, and it's great to be able to kind of get these sort of experiences with games as well, and get to play them a bit early and talk about them.
Yeah, I mean, having seen Galaxy's Edge quite a few times from, you know, friends and family who've been down that way, it's always a little bit of a jealous experience, but I'm definitely trying to live vicariously through you on that. But of course, yeah, you're I guess a part of PlayStation Access, and been there for a little while now. And I think really where I became aware of your work was actually through when you worked with What Culture and working with the team there. And obviously the sort of content there is a little bit different, obviously a lot more sort of list-based content, sort of, I guess, proactive is sort of the way I'd describe it. But obviously with working with PlayStation, it's a little bit more reactionary, you know, demos and trailers and sort of press conferences coming out. Does it feel like there's a bit of a change in the style of content you create and how you approach content, or is it not much of a sort of difference there for you?
Ooh, I think at the heart of it, like, my job at both places is very much watch and play things and enjoy them or don't enjoy them, and then figure out what content I want to make on it. So for What Culture, it was very much watching films. Oh, it's always horror, obviously. But watching films and playing games and stuff, I would always be looking for kind of a point that made sense to extrapolate on, that I could relate other games to. So it was very much, or films to, it was very much thinking like in a spider's web at any moment. Whereas I think with PlayStation Access, it's a lot more of the whole experience. So something like Dredge, which I did a video on recently, was like, instead of looking for the point where it relates to other media and kind of intersects with other things that I enjoy, it was more so looking at it and thinking, right, what can I say about this whole game? What can I say about this whole experience? So it's a bit more that they're not reviews, but like it's a bit more being able to write like a whole video essay rather than break it down into kind of bite-sized chunks, both which I enjoy doing. Like, we do lists on Access too as well, but it's nice to kind of be able to mix up the formats a little bit and try out some different things. And we do live streaming a lot as well, which is really nice because it's very chill sitting and chatting to people and having a nice time and playing some games and showcasing them that way as well. So it's a different approach to the sort of things that I output regularly, but still very fun, and both of them have their merits, you know?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a welcome opportunity to, I guess, flex that creative muscle, so to speak. And I think I think even, you know, obviously with what you do for the No Sleep podcast, obviously contributing with them, I mean, if you haven't guessed, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening, one of Ash's big loves in life is horror, and we will probably dive a little bit deeper into that in the show. But how did that sort of experience come about? I mean, there's a lot of very talented people as I look through the credits of the show and sort of what they bring to it. And how did that sort of opportunity fall on your doorstep?
So it wasn't so much a fall on my doorstep with No Sleep. Like, I went after it. I was like, please, set my voice for you, please. I've read No Sleep, the Reddit forum. That's been a massive part of my personality, of my interest in horror, of kind of just my internet experience in general for years, and maybe even like over a decade, you know, like I've read it years and years and years. And I love that forum deeply. And when I realized they had a podcast as well, that became like, I don't listen to loads of podcasts. I pick and choose, you know, so having for fiction ones anyway, I mean. So having the No Sleep one was such a treat because it was relating back to all these stories that, you know, oh my God, that have just meant so much to me and built up so many different things and been such a mixed bag of different stories. Short form horror is king and they have such a great approach to it. So I listened to that for years and I think I kind of just built up the courage and the confidence after a little while of listening to be like, look, you know, I would love to have a go at this. Like I've done voiceovers, I've done voice work for years now, like when I was, it was after I was at What Culture and when I started at PlayStation, so it's been nearly like 5 years of doing voice work, and I thought I'd love to be able to do this. I really want to be able to do it. So I reached out to them like personally and was like, hey, here's my portfolio, like I love you guys, I love the everything that it was built on with Reddit, and I just really really want to be a part of it if there's any opportunity at all. And you know, they were kind enough to give me a chance, and I've continued doing voices since then, so it's really nice. It's really really nice. But it was very much I went out and was like, please No Sleep, please.
I do love the hustle there, so that's definitely well done. But yeah, I think, you know, the opportunities there, you sort of mentioned, you know, you've worked in voiceover work and creating that sort of content for the past, you know, 5 or so years now. What do you think is next for you? I guess obviously the love of horror is obviously quite strong and pretty evident if, you know, you look at your socials, but do you is that something you want to pursue, I guess, further down the line? Is a career in, you know, horror movies or even horror podcasting, you know, further down the line, something that you want to pursue? What's that sort of looking like for you?
Oh, I'm just happy to sit and soak in any horror that I can. You know what I mean? Like, I love watching the films, playing the games, reading the books, like sticking the posters on my wall. I just really enjoy being able to ingest it and share it. And I think Access is the perfect place to do that for horror games in particular as well. And having like the team around me, I love doing it there. So I think that my plan is to continue to go as I'm going at the moment, you know, like put out the videos, be able to enjoy things and kind of dig into what's scary about them, why they're appealing as a horror piece, and put them out onto a platform where hopefully people enjoy that as well. But yeah, I love what I'm doing and I'd love to just do more of it is always the answer.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a welcome sort of sign. I think if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I think it's definitely a good way to continue on things. But I mean, why horror? I think it's something that I've wanted to ask, I think, when we sort of announced or sort of arranged this this podcast episode. But I mean, for someone like me who, you know, gets scared at the drop of a hat and can't play, you know, barely a Resident Evil game, what makes you want to, you know, watch a certain movie or play a certain game and go, yeah, I want to do that again, I want to continue doing that, and sort of what makes you want to continue coming back to this particular genre or sort of style of media, I guess, and just, you know, continue at it?
Well, first up, Resident Evil's scary. Like, I don't know why you're using that one as the, oh, I can't play a Resident Evil game. Like, I think that's quite brave that you're trying.
Well, I think in certain iterations of the Resident Evil game, it's definitely gone a little bit back on the horror aspect of it. They're obviously 7 and 8 have definitely taken that up a little bit more, but there's definitely a little bit of an action element in there. But obviously we'll be talking about some more, I guess, more straightforward horror games a little bit later. But yeah, no, like it's simply an example I was making, but I think I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Oh no, Resident Evil is great and it is scary, but I think the thing that draws me back to, you know, horror as a genre continually is just it's always experimental. You never know quite what you're going to get. And I know there are formulas and systems to horror that make it make sense. Like, you know there's going to be a final girl. You know that there's going to be a villain. You know there's going to be some evil to overcome with one specific thing that's its weakness that you've got to find out through researching and having a montage of loads of people going to internet libraries. Like, it's kind of all that kind of dealio. And I think horror games in particular kind of can break away from that a lot more. I don't know. It's very much a case of you're always finding something new in horror. There's always something trying to push a boundary that you haven't experienced before. You don't know what's really going to get under your skin or what's going to scare you. And all of it serves a greater like representation, a greater metaphor of exploring the human psyche and different things that kind of affect us. Like, you know, it's the classic Silent Hill 2, like, oh, it's his guilt. Does this represent my guilt? Sort of vibe where it's this deeper feeling, it's this deeper emotion that's then extrapolated and turned into monsters that hunt you down. There's always some deeper meaning to dig into, to find out more from, to think about. And one of my favorite things to do is to sit and watch something, to sit and play something and think, what could this mean? And it doesn't necessarily have to be what the game has laid out. But there's so many different interpretations of it that come from personal experience that make it interesting to a whole wide range of people as well. I just think it's fascinating, and I love seeing where my levels are with it as well. I like to see how much I can go through. I think as like a person who's quite anxious, it's very much a safe space for exploring how far I can push myself whilst knowing that, you know, it's a game, it's a piece of media, it's something that's not going to stick with me forever unless I end up having night terrors about it. But hey, that's the risk, that's the fun, risk reward.
Yeah, I think that's probably the main reason I try to steer clear of games like that. I think the nightmares and things have sort of been a little bit difficult for me to get away from. And I think the example I was probably going to make was more Five Nights at Freddy's. I think the simple sort of jump scares are the things that sort of get me. I'm a little bit on edge, but yeah, obviously there's different layers and different sort of aspects to horror that can always be, I guess, changed and sort of manipulated in different ways. And I think you put it perfectly there. People can see different things in these games. So yeah, I think that's an interesting way to look at horror in general. And I think hopefully it gives me a newfound appreciation for the genre and the medium in general. But yeah, I think
you gotta get in there.
I should probably try more, shouldn't I? Yeah, I think it's been something I've been sort of neglecting in my gaming sort of library, I guess. But speaking of gaming libraries, we will jump over to, I guess, the next part of the show, Ash, where I normally tend to ask my guest about their sort of formative years in gaming and what that was sort of like for them, whether it was, you know, their first memory of a game that they played or their first console. And I guess, what was that like for you growing up? Was there a first sort of interaction with games that sort of brought you onto games, or what was that like for you?
So I was always brought up with games. Like, my dad is a massive nerd, and he spent his childhood playing Dungeons and Dragons and getting every console that he possibly could get his hand on and going to the arcade and all that sort of thing. So when he had me, and I'm an only child, it was like very much passed on that he wanted to share this love of gaming with me. And luckily, I liked it too. So it's very much been a lifelong thing. But the main games that I played growing up were fantasy RPGs, because my dad loves those and I love those as well. But they were the ones that always stuck with me the most. I love high fantasy. I love dragons and goblins and elves and running through the forest and all that sort of stuff. I think it's fantastic. And I think horror sits really well in those spaces as well. Like, going into a dark, horrible cave and a bunch of skeletons jumping out and jumping you know what I mean? Like, there's so much to be said for high fantasy and horror having a kind of line that goes together, from defeating this great evil that tries to take over the land, that's like some horrible horned monster. Oh, I just think it's great. But my formative years were very much built on me hanging out with my dad, us playing PlayStation 2 is the main one that I remember. I know that he had other consoles growing up, but the ones that I remember playing for the first time was PlayStation 2. And we would play the X-Men game. Oh, wow. I played so much Gauntlet Dark Legacy. That's one of my favorite games ever. And Drakan the Ancient's Gates. And we used to go to CEX or Blockbuster and look at the covers of all the games and pick one that had like the most interesting picture on. So we'd always just go for something that had like someone with a sword or a dragon on it and be like, right, we're going to play that this weekend. And that was where it all started with gaming, really.
It's interesting because, like, a lot of people, especially the guests we've had on our show so far, there hasn't been a lot of sort of interactions or sort of bringing things down from family members. So it's definitely been something that they've picked up themselves and sort of, you know, initiated themselves within their family. So it's interesting. Yeah. It's very cool to see how the interests of your father have sort of, I guess, been handed down to you. Obviously, like, I couldn't technically see my dad playing Dungeons and Dragons and trying to bring that to my attention. He's definitely a sort of football and sort of, you know, motor racing sort of person. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like it's so interesting how the interests of one person can always be sort of influenced by, you know, a family figure in that regards. But I think the choices in games that you've made have definitely been very interesting and sort of, I guess, tell me a little bit more about yourself and sort of who you are. And I think that sort of nod to horror again is perfect. But yeah, I guess when you were growing up, I guess, you know, going into more of your sort of high school years and as you're getting older, were there other sort of consoles that you played, and was that sort of influenced by your dad, or sort of were you starting to branch out into your own interests and titles that you were picking up?
So it's a bit of everything. Like, all my family are all, like, my mom and my dad are massive horror fans as well. Like, my dad is a horror movie fan, my mom loves horror books, so that kind of came from them too. But game wise it was very much like I always had my own console in my room, and then I think it was university, I took it with me and started kind of going out and picking different bits that I wanted to play. Very much, you know, gaming can be expensive sometimes, is the truth. So being able to have kind of this hand-me-down selection from my dad, where he would go out and buy something because he wanted to play it, and then, you know, I could have a go on it, made a lot of choices for me. But the main difference between us, I think, is my dad loves, like, proper beautiful graphical, like, massive fantasy epics, and as I've grown I like those, but I don't want to play open world games all the time. They tire me out, so it has to take a really special one to get me in and really play it properly. I think myself as a person, I realized that I like puzzles, I love puzzles, and they come into horror games especially strongly. Like, you take a look at Resident Evil 2 and it's just a gift that keeps on giving with all the horror elements, and also all the times you've got to figure things out and pick up items and put them in different places, and like it's just the gift that keeps on giving. And I think making that connection of realizing, oh my god, this thing that I really love, which is horror, and this is actually what I like in gaming, which is puzzle solving, was such like a revelation. I was like, oh my god, there's so many things that I like. I also love pixel art games. Like, I really like pixel art games, like just like little classic retro looking things, especially if they're horror games. So that has been very much a little bit of a change for me as well, where the graphics don't really matter as much. Like, one of my favorite games of recent years was Bugsnax, and you know, it's I argue that it's a horror game from that ending. It is terrifying. It's not like some major like graphical beast that you're going to play because you can see the ray tracing in their eyeballs or anything. And that was kind of the freeing moment of being like, right, okay, I like all these different things and the different qualities of them. But it always comes back to puzzles for me. Like, I love a good sit down and a figuring something out, and like escape rooms and stuff like that. All that kind of vibe is very much very much my bag.
I would have assumed you must have been over the moon when the remakes of Resident Evil started coming out, obviously 2, 3, and now 4. Obviously, it would have been sort of earlier this month, but you must have been having a great time with these sort of revived and revamped titles.
Oh, yeah. See, interestingly enough, I think people assume that I played the original ones. But I was on that fantasy train, man. I never played the original Resident Evils. So being able to come to them now in their remastered form, when they literally are like top notch, top tier, has been absolutely amazing. Like, I'm very open about the holes I have in different parts of my knowledge set, but yeah, Resident Evil was a big one, and being able to come and experience them now on like modern consoles, and the Resident Evil 4 remake coming out. I've heard so much about Resident Evil 4 throughout my whole life. Being able to dive into that and have my own experience, and it be a little bit different, a little bit changed up, so it's completely new to me, and you know, oh god, I was thrilled. I had the best time. Amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine it's been, I guess, like opening up a present on Christmas morning and not really knowing what it was. But
horrible things come out.
Yeah, having watched a couple of playthroughs of it, there's definitely some interesting things in that game, it's both the original and the remake. But I guess we sort of move on to your sort of present day sort of interests and sort of what you're playing now and what's been sort of taking your fancy. Obviously the horror element is there, but has there been anything else that sort of, I guess, gripped you recently and sort of in the last sort of couple of years, I guess?
Walking Sims was a big one I realized that I really like. So being able to kind of just explore something and soak in the vibes a bit has been a massive treat. The Frictional games, discovering those was incredible. But recently, I definitely have kind of taken the turn towards indie and horror specifically, but indie titles have just totally knocked my breath away, whatever the phrase is. they've been incredible. So Dredge recently has been my absolute favorite. I think it's so good. Madison, Visage, Carrion, Lamentum, loads of stuff like that. Saturnalia. There's all these little experimental games coming out that play with how they look, like the artwork in there that make them kind of surreal and scary for a sense of not quite being able to pin the reality in them, like that uncanny kind of vibe, which I think is so delicious. I think it's great. I also recently discovered, or I say recently, like in the past few years, discovered the Five Nights at Freddy's games, and nothing has made me jump more. But I appreciate that about them as well, as just having kind of that baseline, right, this is here to freak you out as much as possible, see if you can handle it, go. Even though they do have all these masses of lore behind them that are so interesting and all over the place and what you wouldn't expect from a game that's just about a giant animatronic bear coming to get you. But yeah, it's a whole mix of things. It's very much, I think my horizons have opened a lot. And being able to play the big PlayStation titles, obviously, with access has been incredible. Stuff like Horizon and God of War. God of War, oh my God, like that defined me as a person. That like tickled my fantasy bone. And I was obsessed with it when I first played that. And then Ragnarok coming out, it's just, oh, chef's kiss.
Mm. Yeah, imagine the sort of opportunities you've had with access, obviously, you know, even going to LA to play Jedi Survivor, like that would have sort of opened up your eyes to experiencing probably things that I would assume you wouldn't have had the interest in prior to, you know, working at a place like PS Access. But what's that sort of been like for, I guess, expanding your horizon, for... you know, games, you know, within that sort of PlayStation library and sort of experiencing things that you wouldn't have experienced before?
I think it's just always good to get like a wide view on what's going on in whatever medium you're in. So whether that's games, films, books, comics, anything. As much as I have a very keen interest in the subgenre, being horror, like it makes sense and it only contextualizes what the games are within the subgenre if you know the wider thing as well. So it's been it's been very good for you know, broadening the horizons. Oh my God, that's the phrase that's just going to stick throughout all of this. But it has been good for that in particular, because it's constant contextualization of what's going on in the industry, of what people are interested in, of, you know, what different features and things are in new games that can then be taken and twisted into something horrible. Like PSVR2, for example, being able to experience the launch of that and go through all these different VR games. I hadn't really played VR before, so to be able to do that and have that whole technological framing of it was incredible, and have all these different games that we could try out. The Last Clockwinder I really loved, because that's just like an automaton puzzle. And then to see all of those different things, the Sea Smash VR demo, incredible, to kind of play all these different things and then be able to see what someone with a horror leaning can do with it, like Switchback VR, just makes it even more incredible and interesting and you know, innovative. So I think it's really important to be well read in the medium you're interested in, and working for PlayStation has definitely continued that trend of you know, making sure that I've got a little eye on everything going on, as well as the stuff that I'm personally interested in. But all of it's great is the actual bottom line. You know, it's not like anybody's putting out rubbish. It's you're there and it's great, and I'm enjoying myself, whatever the genre is. It's just a massive treat that I get to explore my passion at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually about to mention the PSVR 2, and I think the video of the lead developer, I think it was, of Switchback, sort of responding to pretty much the cut compilation of your screams throughout the entire video, yeah, and him just like giggling like a schoolgirl the entire time, which I thought was pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, I think that sort of leads us quite perfectly to the major part, the meat and potatoes of the podcast today is the game that we've chosen, or that you've chosen, Ash, that you feel has influenced your personal life or your career. And obviously, you know, the theme of horror has been running throughout this entire episode, and it's not going to stop here. What game have you chosen for us today?
So I mentioned a little bit of Walking Sim and Frictional Games earlier, and the one that has stood out to me that I think is well worth diving into is Soma.
Ooh, bringing in the ambience and scaredness to bring that in. But yes, it's an interesting title, because obviously made by Frictional Games, the team behind, I guess, the now legendary Amnesia series. And this was sort of after the sort of first couple of games that they'd done for that series. What was your sort of first interaction with Soma? Were you a fan of the Amnesia series and you've jumped onto this afterwards, or is this something that you've just sort of stumbled upon and very much sort of fallen in love with?
I heard about Soma when I was at What Culture from all of my friends that worked there. I think one of them said to me that it was like one of the scariest things he's played and one of his favorites. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And just like filed that in my brain because I was catching up on loads of other stuff at the time. And eventually I got round to getting the Amnesia collection, playing Dark Descent, Machine for Pigs is in there, and Justine. I really enjoyed it. And Soma was in like the PlayStation store, and I was like, oh, I haven't played that yet. That's a massive like thing that I haven't played, that I've thought about for years, that I want to have a little go on. And it was just one of those moments where I was like, I've got the time, I've got the money, I've got the console, I can do it right now. So I did that. I actually played it with my boyfriend. We were doing it together. So it's an interesting one to have not played it solo. As every other horror game, usually I'm just sat there like in the dark, playing it, trying to freak myself out, whereas it was the pair of us kind of going through and exploring this one at the same time, which I think actually made it better for me, just because okay, there's so many big themes in there to think about and explore. It was very interesting having someone there that's going through it at the same time to be able to say, wow, what do you think about this? What's about this? What do you think we should do here? Like, it was really fun.
I was going to ask, actually, I guess, in terms of whenever you sort of indulge in that horror sort of love, whether it be movies or games, what's the sort of perfect setting for you? Like you said, you know, lights are off, I guess blinds are closed, you're sort of huddled under a blanket. What's the sort of perfect horror experience for you in terms of ingesting this horror experience?
Oh, see, I will play anything at any time of day. I'm very bad for just sticking something on when it's like the middle of the day. But I've got like my perfect little gaming setup in my living room, which is I've got like one of those sofas that has like it's got a long bit so I can stretch my legs out. I've got a big furry blanket. And then if it's night, then we can turn off all the lights and it gets like proper pitch black. And I've got some little RGB lights around the back, which I can change to a different color if I want to, that matches the game.
Nice.
Have it on like green or red for blood. and that's like the ideal. And then shut all the doors, turn all the lights off, put the game on, sit a bit closer so that my eyes go a bit square, and have a great time.
I think it's perfect for this game in question, because like I'll say full disclosure, I did watch as much as I could of a full playthrough of Soma, pretty much with my hands in between my eyes, sort of just blocking out as much as I could. But it is a very interesting game in the sense that you mentioned the Walking Simulator title, and it's very much been something that Frictional Games have been I guess I don't want to say famous for, because obviously it's a genre and a style of game that, you know, extends itself to other sort of genres as well. But the way that that sort of lends itself to the style of horror and the sort of sense of unease and sort of tension within the game, I thought was something that, you know, even for me watching the game, not even playing it, I felt like that butterfly tension, that anxiousness that was always sort of like slowly rising in my chest as something big and clunky was sort of coming around the corner. But it's such an interesting way to view horror, and obviously the sort of tone and sort of discussion and the plot of the game is obviously it gives me headaches almost thinking about it, because it's such an existential crisis almost.
Yeah, for sure. It's the whole thing is, it's just, it's hard to pin down. It's massive. My playthrough of it, I remember it more in feelings than exactly what happens in the game. I remember those as well, because they were like big and scary and you know, massive. But the main thing I think about when I think about Soma is that feeling of like tightness in my chest and this weird pit in my stomach, because I didn't know what to do or how to treat the people in the game, because that's what it's constantly questioning you about, is Soma being like the Greek word for body. It's about how we live and how we continue and what our legacy is, whether it's mental, physical or otherwise, and how that ties into someone experiencing all of this crisis on the bottom of the ocean in an abandoned research facility, making decisions on who lives, who dies, or what lives and what dies, and how you perceive that as the player as well. Oh God, it's just, it's sick in both the ew, gross, and wow, hell yeah sort of interpretations of the word.
I thought it'd be more a little sick in terms of, oh my God, I can't believe you did that, or why would you want to do that, I think is probably my sort of style of thinking in that sense. I think one of the big things that I sort of, one of the things that or moments that really sort of hit me was when, and of course, spoiler warning for anyone who hasn't played it so far, and I guess that goes for any episode in this series, but I think the moment when you meet Sarah, the sort of only, the sort of last living sort of human, fully human person, in the station, and sort of she's basically on an IV drip, on life support, basically, you know, waiting for anyone to come and sort of put her out of a misery. And I think just sort of figuring all of that out and seeing how people's lives aren't particularly full, they aren't particularly sort of, they're not all human, I guess is sort of the big thing there, and sort of deciding who lives and who dies, and that sort of, you know, working out consciousness and how that is sort of transferred into technological advances. It's obviously a really sort of deep and sort of thorough discussion to have, and it's surprising that you're having it in a horror game of all places. Yeah. But I think adding to that, you know, right at the depths of the ocean, one of the scariest places to be ever anywhere in my opinion, and it really just sort of is this beautiful concoction of horror, and, you know, horror in the sense of it being old-fashioned classic horror, but also that sort of terror in sense of, I don't know if this is me or, you know, someone else in my body, and it was just such a really awkward, unnerving feeling that I experienced.
Yeah, for sure. I think the way that the game is set up, so like waking up as Simon, you've been to a brain scan because you've had an injury, and you suddenly snap into another reality where it's, what, 2104? All of humanity has been wiped out on the surface by a comet, and you're in an underwater research facility as perhaps the last person alive, talking to your mate that you find that is a uploaded brain scan into another robot, and then it's figuring out every robot around you, it has some sort of consciousness in it. So when I first started playing, when the game makes you like unplug the first one that you see, that's kind of like, please, no, I need that, like, I want to live, that's kind of like, oh, that's a bit creepy. Oh well, unplug, carry on. And then you meet Carl, I think, who's really demanding that you help him, despite being a robot. He doesn't understand that he's a robot. He thinks that he's a human. And that was kind of unsettling, and there's not much you can do for him. Like, you can figure out how to end him, or you can just leave him. And I decided I'm just going to leave him, because obviously he's having some trouble. Maybe someone else will find him was kind of my thinking. And then I realized, no, it's definitely just me down here. And going through, I kind of had like these debates every time. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to leave them. Every time I found someone, I was like, I'm going to leave them. It's not up to me to make a decision about their life. And the thing that got me was when Simon has to clone himself and then make the decision as to whether to kill the clone or let it live whilst he's in this new body that he's taken from another robot. And it was just this like moment of paralyzation where it's just, I don't know what to do. Like, I know everything about Simon. I've been Simon this whole time, and I've created this thing that I know he's unhappy with because he's expressed all of these concerns and existential dread about not being human anymore and being a brain scan in this like piece of machinery. And now I've made another one of him, and I felt really responsible for it. And like, you know, I've got to get rid of him because, you know, that's my responsibility. And then I was like, well, who am I to make a decision as to whether someone lives or dies? That really got me then. And then you meet Sarah later in the game after you've seen all of these amalgamations of bodies and flesh and mechanical bits and engineering. And you meet Sarah, and she is just a woman, a person on a life support machine. She can only live with the help of technology, just like everything else you've seen down on the bottom of the seabed. Like, everybody else down there is a person and a machine together. So what's so horrifying about those and Sarah's condition being different? Like, it's the same thing. They're still, that's what the game wants to show you. It's like, you know, this woman needs this life support to survive. A, who are you to interfere with that? And does it make it any different kind of life? And B, like, you know, if these things have been expressing that they want to live and you've been unplugging all of their little outlets the whole time, what does that make you? Like, they're sentient, they're conscious, they're people, and you've been interfering with everything that matters to them, that their whole existence. Oh man, just thinking about it makes me go all trippy.
I think the scariest thing that happened was when you do end up pulling the life support out of Sarah, and she basically goes, well, at least I won't have to turn 30. And having just turned 30 about 2 months ago, that made me feel absolutely horrible.
Oh God, so yeah.
That was definitely a big kicker for me. But I think that one of the big things really was, of course, the ending, when you do end up, I guess, launch your sort of consciousness or upload your consciousness into the Ark, which is essentially this massive satellite, I guess, that sort of houses this almost like utopia, this perfect world, alongside Catherine, who I guess is sort of your companion for the entirety of the game, sort of helping you along and I guess being your guide and sort of helping you out. But you find out when it's launched that the identity or the consciousness that you launch for both yourself and Catherine is just, it's a copy. It's not you. You're not on the actual rocket up onto the satellite. It's a copy of yourself. So when you're sort of arguing about it and her sort of cerebral cortex chip, I guess, implodes, it's just you in the bottom of the ocean alone. And that sense of dread and loneliness sort of sets in. But then also you're up in this sort of fake utopian world, and it's so clean and nice, and there's a review like, how do you rate your time in the Ark? Are you happy? Are you enjoying life? And it was such an interesting feeling, because someone said, like, I've been reading comments about it on the plate that I was watching, was there's no good ending here. The Ark is not a good place to be because you aren't human. This is just a construct of your mind. And the fact that you're either alone down at the bottom of the sea by yourself in a half human body, it's your consciousness essentially uploaded into a robot, or you're up in the sky in a fake world that isn't you, and it's just your brain or sort of this idea of a brain telling you what to believe, you're in a rock or a hard place. There's no good ending to this. And I felt like that was really such a powerful way to sort of conclude this sort of discussion on consciousness, existentialism, and all that sort of, those sort of dark topics that you normally don't see in a horror game.
Yeah, for sure. But I think my response to that is mainly like, I don't know if it is a bad ending. Like, what makes someone human? What makes them who they are? Like, what makes it good? If he had, you know, a fleshy body, would that make it the good ending? I don't think it would. Like, I think the whole game is about identity as something separate from the shell you're in, and it doesn't really matter what you're housed in. It matters what you think and feel and the sentience that you have in that sense. Like, Simon is still Simon. He's the same person he was when he had that brain scan right before all of this went down in Soma. And it's his experiences trying to, you know, figure out what's happening to him, who he is, what he is. Like, that his mind makes him think that he is human for a lot of the game before you realise that actually you are housed in an android. It kind of appears that his hand is actually mechanical. I don't know. I don't know if there is a good or a bad ending at all. I agree. But I don't think it's to do with the organic nature of life. I think all of it's just a big, oh man, like, what does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to think and feel if someone's brain was shipped off in a glass jar and sent into space with a bunch of other brains all thinking and talking to each other? What's different to that, to the way that we experience Earth? And there's no real answer to that. There's no real answer to that question. There's no real figuring out or major message to take away. It's just existential consideration, existential dread. It's just the pit in the bottom of your stomach that's telling you this is weird and uncomfortable because I don't know who I am or what I am or how, where it all goes or what it means.
I think that's an interesting sort of discussion to have, and especially in a horror game, and it's not something I expected to have, to be honest, but I think the fact that they do leave it so open-ended or sort of open to discussion or debate like that, I think really serves to make the game that much stronger. And I think it, you know, you can obviously have your simple horror games, your Five Nights at Freddy's, sort of, you know, working on jump scares and simple sort of shock horror, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it. But I think this sort of, not so much body horror, but I think that it's obviously in some ways it kind of is, but the way that they sort of work out that sort of fear of what is human and what isn't, I think makes it such a bizarre sort of horror to sort of work out. And I think that was part of the thing that really sort of stood out to me and really stuck with me even after the times that I'd watched the playthrough. It's definitely something that I would recommend, even from me as a huge wuss. I guess to sort of round up our discussion on Soma, Ash, what is it about the game, I think, what is it about it that sort of was influential for you in terms of your personal life or your career? How did that sort of, I guess, become such a big part of your personality, I guess, even, and how was it important to you?
I think Soma was one of the standout games that really terrified me. Like, I think is just the right word. I think it really dug into me and made me question things, and it made me jubilant that this was in a horror game and that horror can reach these kind of cerebral messages, these cerebral questions that, I don't know, it's really special to me. I just think that it's a complete peak point in what horror represents to me, which is digging into these fears, these, you know, these strange points, these taboo topics that don't make sense but are part of who we are as the human race. Like, we've all got this fear in us. That's why we have like the phrase existential dread. Like, it's real and it's there, and we all kind of have it at some points, and we squash it down and don't think about it. And Soma brings it all to the forefront and says, hey, look at this. This is incredibly weird to think about, don't you think? And there's a way that we all feel it in everyday life, never mind in 2104, where science has, you know, changed everything about how we perceive our bodies. It's seeing Sarah and thinking, oh my God, we're actually in that reality right now, and all of these thoughts and feelings we have about it are applicable to the everyday. I think all of that knowledge and insight and questioning that Soma has is incredible. and has always sat with me in the back of my mind whenever I'm playing games and playing horror games. And you know, I want to hit that height again. I want to be made to feel that way. Also, the on just a really base level, there's a really scary bit where you have to run through a tunnel and it's full of crab spiders. And then you come out at the end and you get eaten by a giant anglerfish. And it's really horrible. It really made me upset having to see all those spiders in underwater. Genuinely, it was horrible. And that's one of the scariest moments I've had in a horror game that just made me go, oh.
Yeah, I jumped a little at that. I'll be quite honest. I struggled to sleep that night. But yeah, I think it you know, you go.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, I hate spiders. I hate spiders. And I thought I was playing this cerebral game of life and death and body horror where, you know, organic meets inorganic. And then actually, no, there's just a big tunnel of spiders that you have to walk through. And that was just like, oh, thanks, guys. Thanks. This as well.
Yeah, I felt like the only sort of major horrors that I had to go through were the existential type and worrying about myself and you know, the future of man and all that. And not this sort of massive fish people living on the bottom of the ocean who are trying to chop my head off while I'm trying to walk past the lights and dealing with anglerfish. It's like, that's another sort of horror thing for me of a different kind. Like, don't show me a picture of an anglerfish. I will, yeah, it's not particularly great. But I think, yeah, rounding it all up, I think it is definitely a game that says a lot of different powerful things and things that I definitely wasn't expecting in a horror game. So I think, yeah, you've definitely hit the nail on the head there.
For sure. I think the epitome of Soma, the simplest way of boiling it down, is saying it is everything about the fear of the unknown. It's the bottom of the ocean. It's the deepest part of the sea that we're never actually going to see or experience. And seeing what's at the bottom of it, it's all these giant fish. And then they've been changed into something by, you know, all of this inorganic mechanical matter that has influenced them as well. So it's like, oh, God, you don't actually know what's at the bottom of this place or what it could be. It's thinking, you know, about what it means to be alive, and there's knowing that there's no answer. It's the unknown there. It's throwing your brain into the depths of space and not knowing what's going to happen to it or where it's going to go or what it's going to intercept or what you're going to see. It's all of these things in one. And horror always, always functions best when you don't know what's out there. It's the suggestion at the edge of your consciousness, you know, it's that kind of implication that there's something out there that will hurt you or that could hurt you or that could be so incomprehensible it sends you insane. It's that Lovecraftian cosmic influence, and Soma absolutely embodies that in every way, shape and form.
And I think the perfect way to end is that to I guess provide the information that the engine that this game ran on is the HPL engine, which was named actually after HP Lovecraft. So I think that's a perfect way to round it up. But yeah, Ash, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode and giving us a lovely insight into all things horror and I guess the human psyche, which was not a discussion that I was expecting to have on a gaming podcast. But yeah, where can people find you on the socials and I guess the work that you've been doing?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me as well. It's been really nice to be able to talk about it. But my socials, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Twitch at Ash Millman. And I work for PlayStation Access, which is PlayStation Access on YouTube. The No Sleep Podcast is called The No Sleep Podcast. You can find that on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. And I think that's everything.
I think you've covered it quite well, yeah. And of course, if you'd like to follow what we're doing here at One Perfect Game, you can always do so at OPGPod on Twitter. You can also follow me on Twitter at It's Tilby. But yes, that is it for another episode, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening. From myself, Matt Tilby, and my very special guest, Ash Millman, it is goodbye for now. Take care.
Bye.